Yay, Christina.
Yay, Christina.
Thank you. I feel like I want to say Merry Christmas. Can I say Merry Christmas? I have a daughter who is like one of those who wants to celebrate 20 days before we even get to Thanksgiving. And I'm like, just hold on, hold on. And now she's wearing her Christmas clothes every single day. So Merry Christmas, because it's happening in our family. Nancy, you know I've asked you to share, and I was super excited that you were willing to share your spotlight today. And I also just want to say, I'm going to cry. It is a gift to see God at work in your life right now. And I have been so blessed as you have just said, I'm listening to that pointer. And so thank you for sharing this morning. I was super excited to have you do that. So, all right, I'm excited to get into the Sermon on the Mount and loving your enemies. And it's funny, I went and looked for some stories online about loving your enemies. And I will tell you, it was much easier to find stories about hating your enemies. I read one where there's a luggage porter who at an airport, and somebody was like, that person was just treating you terribly. Like, how did you respond so nicely? And he's like, oh, I didn't. Actually, I sent their luggage to Italy when they were going to Australia. Or another one where there's a woman who said they said you're diagnosed with rabies, and she goes, oh, good, now I can go bite some people. there was also a story about a little boy who had been serving some soldiers, regularly serving them soup. And the soldiers had been kind of teasing him and all these things. And then finally they're like, we're just kidding. We were just teasing. And he goes, well, that's good because I've been spitting in your soup. So, but then my favorite was the 100-year-old man who was asked, who are your enemies? He said, I do not have any enemies. And everybody was like, wow, that's amazing. He goes, they're all dead. So I loved, actually, when Anne was reading Luke, it was fun because I saw many of you going, wait, we're in Matthew. Why is she reading Luke? What's going on here? So I love that you're paying attention. Yes, that was not the passage that we actually read today, but we will kind of talk about that one. And since it was a longer passage, I had her read that. But I do want to just go over our passage this morning. We're in Matthew 5, 43 through 48. If you want to turn to page 111. I just want to say that this is another one of those flipping things around that Jesus is doing. And so it's saying in this passage, so Pharisees, scribes, Jews, you have heard it said to love your neighbor and hate your enemy. And then Jesus says, but I'm telling you, I want you to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you so that you may be children of your Father in heaven. And then it talks about how God causes the sun to rise and on the evil and the good, and he brings rain for the righteous and the unrighteous. And then it says, if you're loving those who love you, what does that mean? That's easy. Even the tax collectors do that. And if you greet your own people, what does that mean? What is that doing? Pagans do that. So he's calling us to something greater. And then he says, and this should all make you go, ooh. therefore, be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. And we will tease out what that actually means, okay? But I want to tell you that I don't often do this, but when I was preparing the study guide this summer and I was, you know, going through each of these chapters, when I told you that this is a butt kicker of a Sermon on a Mount for me, it was actually this passage. And it's one where I actually specifically requested to teach it because I felt like God was really going, he had the pointer on my forehead. And I'll share with you a little bit why that was, but I have, during the summer, I had somebody that I felt like there was a lot of animosity and opposition that I was experiencing from this person. And I was struggling as to how to navigate that. And I felt like God was going, this is how I want you to do it. And we'll talk about that a little bit. But I was super convicted. And it's a tough relational passage. And I feel like I want to say to you guys this morning that I want your posture to be one, and Anne kind of even prayed this, to be one of listening, not for the meaning of the passage, even though we'll get into that. But I want you listening with your heart. And I'm actually asking God for each one of us to place people on our mind and heart that he's wanting us to love. in a new and different way than we have been. And it's probably going to be one of the hardest people in your life to do that with. And so that's the posture that I want us to bring to this morning. Even though we will get into the nuances of the passage, I want us coming just asking God to change our hearts toward people. And it's interesting, in commentaries, some would say that this is kind of the apex of the Sermon on the Mount, that it's kind of going, and you hit this one, it's like, wow, okay. And then we've got others that they're not downhill. Maybe we'll plateau them, but that this is a very key passage that we're dealing with, and it gets to the heart of a lot of things. And there's others that would say this is actually kind of miraculous, that if we want to be people who see miracles, loving our enemies is literally a miracle. And so God has to do that kind of work. I loved when Sherry taught a couple weeks ago. I hope you guys, if you didn't hear that, I feel like, Sherry, I haven't told you this, but I feel like that was a pivotal teaching on this, on the Sermon on the Mount, in that she shared with us what God is doing with the Pharisees and the scribes and how he's trying to tease out the law for us. And so that teaching was really essential. If you missed that, I would highly recommend that you listen to it, because we actually didn't end up videotaping it. But it is available for listening. But one of the things Sherry mentioned is that Jesus is addressing some underlying issues in this sermon. The purpose of the Old Testament law is being addressed, and the scribes and Pharisees have twisted God's law. That is key to understanding this. They have twisted it, and Jesus is explaining the law in light of his own life and his future death. And so we're getting this explanation of the law through the Sermon on the Mount. The audience was these Jews, as Jesus is teaching, who were trying to follow the law perfectly. That was their way to God, was to follow the law perfectly. So that's their heart, is they're trying everything they can to follow the law perfectly, but they have all these twisted and distorted things that they're following. And I want to point out something else. You have to think that in that time, not everybody had a Bible that they were reading, right? So they couldn't necessarily go back to Leviticus and go, okay, what did that passage actually say? It was a time of oral tradition. So whatever people were saying was actually what they were learning. And so that oral tradition, if they're hearing a distorted truth, it's not like it's easy for them to go to the passage and go, wait a second, this is distorted. They just were going off of the oral tradition. And Terry had shared about this culture of retaliation, which, again, awesome teaching, just gave great insights into the culture of honor and shame and things like that. But it was essential in that culture to retaliate to restore your honor. That was just an essential part of that culture. So if you were shamed in any way, you wanted to restore your honor. And so Jesus is saying, I'm calling you guys to something really much bigger and much deeper. And this, I want to point out, the Sermon on the Mount is not how we earn being a part of God's family. That is not what the Sermon on the Mount is. The Sermon on the Mount is what reflects being what it is to be part of God's family. And that's an important distinction. It's not that he's saying, this is what you do to be part of my family. It's that those who have the Spirit of God working in my life, this is what it looks like. This is what it looks like to be part of God's family. So let's look first at this distortion. You can move to the links. Oh, I don't have it. Oh, I have the clicker. Thanks. This is kind of our outline. We've got the distortion in this passage. We've got the call. We've got the reason, and then we've got a challenge. And so we'll get into all of these. Let's first talk about this distortion. The actual passage that the Pharisees and scribes were quoting was from Leviticus 19:18, and it said, "Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against anyone among your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." So it was actually interesting that you have to kind of give them the fact that they said, okay, love your neighbor. That's what it's calling us to. But they then assumed that the flip side was also true. So if you're called to love your neighbor, then you can hate your enemy. And that really aligns again with this honor shame culture. You want to restore your honor. So you're going to have to rise up in defense of yourself and hate your enemy. Okay. So you need to see the tie in there. And it was a culture of retaliation. They wanted to protect their honor. And we just have to acknowledge, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, this is the most natural way to respond as a human being. So when the Pharisees said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, that felt natural. That's what we do. We want to punish those who hurt us, and we want to defend ourselves when we face opposition. And so then Jesus is giving us this totally, he's flipping everything they understood. I mean, you have to realize this is ingrained in these people. And he's going and he's flipping it completely on its head. And he's saying, actually, I want you to not only love your neighbors, I want you to love your enemies. And I think it's important that we kind of talk about this concept of enemy. I have a feeling that few of us would actually, there may be some of us, and that's real, that would say that you have an actual enemy in your life. But most of us probably wouldn't use that term. Most of us wouldn't say, oh my gosh, that person is my enemy. We are in total opposition. Most of us just experience deep hurts and wounding from people. And that creates in us this desire to defend, this desire to oppose when we're deeply wounded and we're deeply hurt, especially if there isn't a deeper love there to bank on. So when we talk about enemy, I almost kind of want to not use that term, even though I will because it's biblical. But I feel like I want you guys to look at this as it's those who have shown us hostility, those who have harmed us, those who have opposed us. And that does, it creates in us this internal animosity when we experience that resistance from somebody. Maybe we could describe it as a resistance. So this passage is really anyone who hurts us. It's the person that's not natural to love. It's the person that's harder to love. And we can see this on a continuum. It could be those who simply irritate us on this side of the continuum, and that makes them hard to love. Or it could be those who are truly seeking to take us down. And there are those people who have people in their life truly seeking to take them down. And then it could be just severe opposition to minor snubbing. Like you just get snubbed by somebody and it's like you want to respond to that in a way and so our enemy can be both the fleshly things of sinful man, or it can actually be the capital enemy actually seeking to destroy. But I want to also point out that God allows enemies, quote unquote, in our life because he wants to do a work in us. He wants to get our attention, and he wants to accomplish a purpose in us when that happens. And so he's shaping us when he allows us to experience animosity in that way. This passage specifically describes a couple types of enemies, those who persecute you or have harmful intentions toward you, those who are unrighteous, and those who don't love us, those who aren't loving toward us. And so that's how this passage describes it. So as I use the term enemy, I want you to think far more broadly to anybody in your life that's hard to love, and for whatever reason, very minor or large. And I can assure you we all have those. We're human, right? And so I want you, even as we're talking through this, to think, okay, who is God calling me to love in a new and different way that reflects his love? So let's talk about this concept of love. This is different than our lovey-dovey love. This love is an act of our will. It is literally that we have to choose to love. It's not an emotional feeling that Jesus is describing here. It's a choice. It's actually a way of life. The term here is the agape love. It's this selfless, valiant, courageous, and righteous decision to love somebody. So when he's calling us to love, it's not that you're going to have these feelings of love toward this person. You're actually not feeling that. You're feeling the exact opposite. It's that you're going to choose to love them despite what you're feeling. You're going to go against your natural tendency. This is, we just have to say, an absolute divine love. This is not human. It's not human to do that. When we feel those feelings of animosity, it's not based on our natural affinities. You know, I've got a 12-year-old, and she's in the throes of relational dynamics at this stage of life. And it's interesting, from very early on, you see that she's a doll, so I don't want, I didn't ask her if I could share this, shoot. Okay, you can see very early on, when there are relational challenges, that the desire is to be mean back, to hurt back, to go and do exactly what that person has done, but greater. That is the natural inclination of our soul. And so what Jesus is, he's saying, I want you to go completely against the natural inclination of your soul. So the conversations that I'm having with my 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old daughter is, actually, God's calling you to love that person. And she's going, what the heck? Right? What? Now, how is that possible? And it feels very anti what's in her. And we're calling her to choose something different. Something else. So the command, God is saying, I want you to extend my grace to all who have been hostile, those who have harmed you, those who have hurt you, those who have opposed you. And we just have to acknowledge in this moment how crazy that actually is. And for the people that would have been listening to this, that would have been like, that sounds so shameful that there's no, like, what? How can I not restore my honor? And so this is a huge high calling that is far beyond our human tendencies. Basically, Jesus is saying the disposition of your heart towards someone is not to be determined by the actual recipient. Did you catch that? The disposition of your heart towards someone is not to be determined by the actual recipient. The disposition of your heart is should be led by your commitment to your Father's heart. Thank you, Stacia. I don't get amens very often. I'll take it. So our disposition isn't about who we're loving. The disposition of our heart is about we want to be reflective of our Father's heart. And so interestingly, in this call, and this I appreciate that Anne mentioned this, is this call to actually pray for our enemies. And this just in and of itself goes against that fleshly desire. To pray for somebody is a loving thing, but you can pray with this desire to, let's just say, have them taken down. Vindicate me. show your power. This call to pray. I think my notes might be in. Hold on one second. Gotta fix these notes, not in order. I didn't number my pages, which is always a problem. Okay. But we're being called to basically do the same thing that God did. Okay, so I want you to think about this. He gave, Jesus was the perfect example of this. He loved and prayed for and forgave his enemies while he was on the cross. So we look at this passage. Oh, wait, there's Leviticus, by the way. Jesus says, on the cross, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. He is this perfect example of this love that goes beyond human understanding to say, I forgive those who are persecuting me, those, and I'm even praying for them. Stephen was also such a perfect example of this. Stephen was the one in Acts who was stoned to death because of his faith. And as he's being stoned, falling on his knees being stoned, he cried out with a loud voice, Lord, do not hold this sin against them, as he's dying. It's powerful. That is loving your enemies. This sets us completely apart from non-believers. Outside of the Spirit of God, I don't know how we do this. Loving those who love us is no different than any unbeliever. Any unbeliever can love those who love them. Pagans, and he says in the passage, pagans and tax collectors do that. Come on, people. Anybody can do that. He's calling us to be completely different in our love, a love that goes way beyond what's ordinary into what's extraordinary. And it can only happen by the power of the Holy Spirit. I love that song. They will know we are Christians by our love, but that came to mind as I was, that's so old school. That came to mind as I was prepping this. Just, they know us by our love, but it's not our love for those who are easy to love. They know us by our love for those who are hard to love, for those who it's really painfully difficult to actually do that kind of loving toward them. So what does this love look like? It's not just niceties. I was thinking about the situation I'm in. It was very easy to have niceties. That was not hard. This isn't just about niceties. And it's not just that we let someone off the hook. There's actually part of that that's unhealthy. So it's not that it's letting the person off the hook. As Anne said, it's actually asking God to bless them. It's asking God to want, it's actually praying for good for them. It's asking God to pour his grace over them. It's not a prayer that says, deal with them, make them stumble, let them get caught, give them the punishment they deserve. You're actually saying, God, be gracious with them. Bless them. Whoa. this is honestly where I got punched in the gut. Because it was easy to pray for this person in certain ways. It was really hard if I imagined God actually answering the prayer to bless them. There's a part of that that actually hurts. Like, no, I want to be vindicated. I want to be, I don't, and I had to deal with what was in my soul on that, is that I was actually going to struggle if he blessed them. And he was saying, I not only want to bless them, I want you to pray for that to happen, and I actually would want you to delight in seeing it happen. And that was hard for me. I wish it wasn't, but it's the truth. It was really hard. And it's not that we're about, it's not that we're saying, hey, I want to go on a vacation with this person, or I want to go hang with this person. It's that you're saying, God, I want you to extend grace to them in the same way you've extended grace to me. And if we recognize how maimed we are and how broken we are and how desperate we are for grace, then we do want to see anybody who's doing that to have that grace extended to them. We kind of have to know our own maiming and our own need for grace to want that for somebody else when we see that, when we experience this brokenness. Is this denial? It's not denial. It's not a repression. That I will say, I won't get into the psychology. That is not healthy. but it's a full realization of how you have been harmed, how you have been hurt, how you have been opposed, and it's choosing to love them anyways. And it's choosing to long for God to pour out his grace on them. I can just say, this is impossible without being regenerated by the Holy Spirit. It truly is. When we love and pray for our enemies, and when this truly happens, we can trust that God is doing a tremendous work in our soul, because that is the work of the Spirit. And we also know when we observe somebody else doing that, that the Spirit is doing a tremendous work in their soul, when we can see that. The beauty of the Christian life is that the supernatural has been made natural by the Spirit of God. So he's calling us in to do what is supernatural, and he can make it natural in us by his Spirit. The greater the suffering, the greater the offense, the greater the hurt, the greater the harm, the greater the work of the Spirit to love. So we just acknowledge it requires more and more, the greater the pain. And so that's a process. If we're expecting one another to step up and do this, after severe pain, we're not doing right by them, but we want to help the Spirit to move in a way to move them toward that love and that. So we can't expect this to be an overnight, oh, now I can suddenly pray for this person to be blessed, like that passage that we read in here. I don't know how he did that. but I think that, again, is the Spirit's work. It takes time. We need the Spirit to work. So Jesus's point is, don't stop loving because the person does things that offend you or dishonor you or hurt your feelings or anger you or disappoint you, frustrate you, threaten you, or even kill you. Love them. Keep on loving them. Keep on loving them. Oswald Chambers actually put it this way. Jesus's teaching becomes a ripping and tearing torpedo, right? Are you feeling that right now? that splits into atoms every preconceived notion a person ever had. When we realize that we cannot love our enemies, we cannot bless those who curse us, we cannot come anywhere near the standard revealed by Jesus, then we are in a condition to receive from God the disposition that will enable us to love our enemies, pray for those who spitefully use us, and to bless those who hate us. So when we recognize we can't do this, that actually puts us in a posture for God to do that work in us, that we are desperate for him to do that. The passage that Anne read is a perfect example of this. I actually love it. Jesus was being asked, who is your neighbor, right? And this passage is about loving your neighbor. So basically they're going, how far do I have to expand this circle of love, right? And Jesus in his analogy or in his, what the story that he shares is this Samaritan person chooses to love this person on the side of the road. And I will tell you that Dave actually talked about this very recently. There is the depth of the animosity between these two people could not be greater than any animosity we understand. Like, it was so severe, the animosity, and that Samaritan went and loved them. And he's basically saying it's loving your enemies is loving your neighbor. And so Jesus went way beyond and gave us this picture of what it means to love your neighbor. And he's saying it means loving your enemy as well, which is why I had Anne read that. So then we have this, what's the reason? What's the why? And he says, so that you can be like me. I want you to be like me. And I'm one who, and he shares with us his character. He's our Father loves his enemies every day, providing sun and rain for them, showing mercy and patience for all who have dishonored him. This passage talks about what's called common grace. It's different than saving grace. It's that God pours out his common grace on all people. God's goodness is to everybody in the sense that it's not because he'll give heat, he'll give light, he'll give rain, he'll give abilities, he'll give talents to everybody. That's his common grace. It says in the word, every good and perfect gift is from above. So anything that is gracious and good is from our Father, and it's common grace being extended to all of us. That's what this passage is describing. And he's saying, this is a complete love. When I love even those who hate me, even those who want nothing to do with me, I, as God the Father, love everybody in this way. This is my common grace. And then he says, I want you to extend this common grace to others. I want you to have this kind of complete love. We're called to be a model of the same goodness of God to all people. So he's saying, I'm your example, and I want you to be like me. I do this. I love my enemies. Jesus showed us that on the cross, and I want you to do the same. And then we have this challenge at the end. It says, be perfect as I am perfect. Every time I read that, I'm like, but that's because I haven't fully understood it. But I will share with you a little bit of what that means. This sentence should cause us to do a double take. But is it actually calling us to perfection? No. Jesus is clearly aware we are not going to be perfect, and though he is perfect, okay? So I want to point this out. It's not an expectation to reach moral perfection. Impossible, okay? The Greek word is actually teleos or telios. I don't know how to say Greek, but it's spelled T-E-L-I-O-S. And its meaning is actually to be mature or complete or consistent and perfect. It's used in a couple other passages in Ephesians 4:13 and Philippians 3:15, and it's used there as mature. He's saying, I want you to become mature, and I want your love to be complete like my love is complete. So it's tying back to this passage and saying, my love is complete, and I'm calling you to that too. I want you to offer a complete love to people. The mark of perfection is for our love to not be conditional. That's the mark of perfection here. That our love isn't conditional, It's unconditional. The Father gave everything for us, and he calls us to give everything for him, whatever that cost is, and we're being called to imitate him. Loving those who are just those who love us is not a complete love, is what he's saying. It's not a perfect love. It's not a mature love. Loving those who we have been hurt by, that is a mature love. That is a complete love. That is a perfect love. In Luke, it actually says the corresponding passage in Luke, which is Luke 6:26, says, "Be merciful as your Father is merciful. Be perfect as I am perfect. Be merciful as your Father is merciful." Basically saying, again, show a complete mercy, show a complete love. This perfectness is a consistency of God's love to all. So he's saying, I want you to be equally consistent. I shared with you that my gut punch was when I was being called to pray for this person and pray for them to actually be blessed and to experience God's goodness in rich and deep ways. And I've been super challenged by that ever since. It's not like that's been an easy process. What I will say is when I sat down to teach the passage again, like to teach the passage after having prepped the study guide, I was again gut punched. And interestingly, the thing that got me this time is that I was reading a commentary that said, oftentimes when we're so deeply wounded or we're hurt, people don't even know that they've done that. And it made me go, I may not know that I have done just that to somebody else. And it just left me on my knees going, God, I am desperate for the same kind of love to be extended to me, where I have hurt and wounded and struggled, and I haven't even known it. And I need your uncommon grace. I need you to show your grace to me. And I think it's this, when we can come to this realization that we are just as capable of being the person who hurt, who opposed, who harmed, and that we are desperate for people to extend this kind of love to us, I think it makes us go, oh my gosh, okay, I need this, so help me do this for those who have been doing that to me. And so that was my double gut punch on this passage, is the praying and then just the realization I've been doing the same. I have what I would call a loving checklist for you, for your enemy. I'm not a checklist person. Well, I actually am. Maybe I am. I don't know. Loving those who hurt you. I feel like these are things that just go against the grain for us. Don't tell others what they did to you. Seeking to affect their reputation. I will tell you that in the situation I was in, there were times when I wanted to share with people what I was experiencing, not because I needed to share it and have healing, because I did actually want them to look at that person differently. And that is not okay. And that is, we can share these things with friends. We obviously need to have those places that are healthy and safe to share about those wounds, but not for the sake of destroying somebody's reputation. We don't want to do anything that would incite fear in that person. And this may not be our natural tendency as women, but for men, I think especially this could be very hard, is that they want to make them afraid of how they'll respond. We can do that in subtle ways, we women. I'm just saying. So not wanting to do things that, like, to make them afraid that you're going to destroy their reputation or that you're going to do something that would be damaging to them. We don't want to do anything that would create that kind of fear. Don't heap guilt on the person. That's not loving. Let them save face. Protect them from shame. If they have truly done something, the way to let them save face is going to look different for each person, but we don't want to shame them. We don't want to dishonor them. And then lastly, pray for God to actually bless them. Pray for God to move. And that, to pray it in such a way where you actually can want God to answer that prayer. Gosh, that is asking him to do a work in us to do that. As I was looking and thinking about people who have so modeled loving your enemies, one of my heroes is Corrie Ten Boom. If you don't know her story, she was in the Holocaust and affected in the camps. And this woman loved those who had destroyed everything in her life. After she was freed from the camps, she had lost literally everything, her family, her sister, everything. She set up a home of restoration for the Nazis who had been destroying her life, basically. And I want to share a quote from her, and we'll end with this. "Even as the angry, vengeful thoughts boiled through me, I saw the sin of them. Lord Jesus, I prayed, forgive me and help me to forgive him. Wait, Jesus, I cannot forgive him. Give me your forgiveness. And so I discovered that it is not our forgiveness anymore than our goodness that the world's healing hinges upon, but it's Jesus's. When he tells us to love our enemies, he gives along with that command the love itself. We have been recipients of that love, and he's calling us to give it to everybody and make it complete. Let me pray. Father, I feel gut punched. God, we want to be transformed. Lord, I think of every woman here, and if there's somebody on their mind and heart that they wouldn't necessarily use the term enemy, but they've felt animosity or struggle with, Lord, I ask that you would show us what it means for that specific person, for us to show them your love, to show them your common grace, to love without condition. Lord, I acknowledge that there are women in this room who have deep, searing, awful hurts, things I cannot even imagine. I don't know how, but by your Spirit, that work can be done. And so we're asking your Spirit to come and move us. Lord, if this kicks up pain and things for people, I ask that this would be a safe place in our small groups for people to be vulnerable about that and talk about the struggle. Lord, ultimately, we want your truth to shape us. We want to be changed. So God, make us women who love perfectly in all our imperfectness. Come and do that work. I pray this in your name. Amen.